Hollywood is rated LGBT radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, good morning, good day. Whenever you happen to be listening to our podcast, we welcome you. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. We are an award-winning podcast. We made several of the best of lists of 2019 and list of the most important LGBT podcasts to listen to for 2020. So we are glad you are joining us. Today we have a very important show, hopefully one that will lead you to wanting to get involved and get active, because some of our most vulnerable families across the country are under attack. And that attack is appearing to be a coordinated effort, putting up bills in different state legislatures across the country, especially in states that are on the more conservative side. They're highly restrictive. They are attacking families who have young kids who are coming out as transgender, and the parents who want to help and nurture those kids, as well as the physicians who are being asked to take care of them, and putting horrific restrictions on all of the above, and in a very ignorant and dangerous way. To discuss this today, we are going to have on a couple of high-level guests, Debbie Jackson, who is a famed parent of a transgender child and who is a transgender rights advocate for the Human Rights Campaign's Parents for Transgender Equality Council, will be with us, plus one of our favorite guests, author Bryn Tannehill, analyst and also author of the book Everything You Want to Know About Being Transgender But We're Afraid to Ask. And of course, my very, very esteemed co-host Brody Levesque will be on again also. I do want to remind you before we get started that Rated LGBT Radio is proudly sponsored by the Los Angeles Blade newspaper. And this week in the LA Blade, we want you to focus on an article that examines the controversy sparked when LA County announced it would no longer pay for STD screenings. This is a move that jeopardizes not only public health, but the finances of the local LGBT community. So very important to take a look at that. Also in the LA Blade this week, news about the Buttigieg endorsements and the LA Blade's sizzling Best of LGBTQ LA event. The LA Blade is the Los Angeles Metroplex's only weekly paper and is distributed in both print and online. And you can find out more at www.losangelesblade.com. So definitely check out the Blade. Also sponsoring the show is the Watson Agency for those in California. Watson Agency provides insurance for home, auto, life, and business for LGBTQ families, individuals, and businesses. So check them out. You can call them at area code 831-536-4817 for more information. And with that, I'd like to invite on Brody Levesque. Brody, welcome to the show.
Hey, Rob. Good afternoon, and good afternoon, good morning, good day to our listeners. Yeah, it's been a hectic week. Once again, the United States Senate is wrapped up in the impeachment trial of President Trump. The last couple of days have been running and evolving around the House managers and the president's lawyers both asking questions from senators. The most shocking thing that has been probably said in all of that was late yesterday evening, one of the president's defenders, Professor Alan Dershowitz of Harvard basically said that the president, if he was acting in good faith for his reelection, could not be impeached for his actions as long as he thought that he was doing something for the state in terms of his conduct. So that kind of set everybody a little bit aback, going, this is a constitutional lawyer, and he just said that we can't impeach Trump for foreign influence, because if Trump feels it's good in his capacity to be the president and working towards the state, it's a good thing. So that's being pretty hotly debated.
Brody, I have a question on that, because that absolutely horrified me when I heard that. I mean, beyond what you're saying in terms of where he's saying you can't impeach Trump, et cetera, but what I took away from that is that he was saying that any sitting president could do whatever he wanted to do for his own best interest to be reelected if that president felt his own reelection was in the best interest of the country, which is sort of a mindless thing. Of course, any president with any agenda is going to think that of himself or herself. I just found that horrifying, that if they acquit Trump on that basis, the precedent that this sets, this is beyond the pale. This is beyond the he didn't do it, anything like that. This, just the fact that he's setting it on this principle, seems outrageous to me.
Well, and not only that, but it more or less codifies what a lot of people have been saying, at least conservative commentators themselves even took note of the fact that this is an area where, regardless of who's in office, it really becomes a one-party rule type of situation, which is extremely dangerous. And that means that you have opened up the door for having an autocrat sitting behind the resolute desk in the Oval Office, beyond Trump even. So it really does open up. And of course, the progressives and the liberals are going off the rails with this. But there are even some conservative commentators that, this one caught them off guard, because it is not an argument that people really wanted to hear. And it certainly isn't an argument that's sitting too well with a lot of other folk. And it remains to be seen. Now, there are other constitutional lawyers that are going to be problematic at best. So we're going to have to wait and see.
This is a scary presentation. I mean, it's so odd. You have Alan Dershowitz, who of other things on his resume, was part of the lawyer team for O.J. Simpson, who obviously is a talented orator of twisting things, and he does what a lawyer does, which is to present a case to get his client off. And then, Pam Bondi, who was a complete conflict of interest person, arguing conflict of interest when she herself turned a blind eye to another Trump lawsuit where she was responsible for pursuing it. It's just, this is like a total kangaroo court.
It is. I mean, it, looking at it, it's become a little bit ridiculous in terms of any action other than the president being acquitted. And I think that most people are looking at it that way. Right now, even the issue over witnesses will probably be voted down. And they thought at first that there might be enough support to get four Republican senators to cross the aisle. And it doesn't appear that that's going to happen. So if there are no witnesses and no documents that come out forthcoming, then you're looking at this weekend being the end of the trial with an acquittal, which is going to give Trump even more of a reason to believe that he can you know, operate any way he pleases because there'll be no consequences for his action. This will embolden him and then some.
Right. So, yeah, okay. Well, we're going to keep an eye on that. But speaking of keeping an eye on everything that's happening, while this is happening at the federal level, everybody's attention is on that. Some pretty insidious stuff is happening at the state level, which is what our show is about today. Can you give us a little background on all that?
There has been a concerted effort over probably the last year, but within the last 9-month period of time, that the conservative right has launched an attack, this time against trans kids and their parents and even their healthcare providers. And it's pretty onerous. We've been able to determine that the language of these different legislators using the same. We have 8 right now: Missouri, Florida, Illinois, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Kentucky, South Dakota. These have introduced bills that are going to punish doctors as well as the parents. They're essentially, and I will let our guests speak to this, but the essence of it boils down to they're trying to make a parent's ability to let their child be themselves a crime. It will be child abuse. It will be chargeable. They are trying to make it where doctors who are willing to assist the parents in helping the children more or less accomplices to the fact, and they will charge them criminally. It's an approach that really got cranked up after a really bloody and nasty custody battle in North Texas over a transgender girl, and between the father and the mother. The mother, ironically enough, is a physician. And out of that, some rather shadowy groups behind the scenes decided to get involved, and they've now put out this boilerplate legislative effort that these states are picking up on to see what, you know, can be done. It essentially would regulate trans kids out of existence at the end of the day. So this goes far and beyond the usual. Now, the only difference is these bills are not being constructed anywhere near any kind of religious or theocratic doctrine. These legislators are honing in on a biological definition, and they're honing in on an area that they think that they can win in court with. And this is really where the problem is.
Definitely. And it's hitting in an area where people who are ignorant of transgender science are, on the face value, think, you know, they can be become alarmed around, like that little kids are being operated on against their will, et cetera.
Right.
Which is
exactly
is not the case, but is how this is presented on kind of an emotional level type of appeal. Well, let's bring on our guests who I'm sure have a lot to say on this. So with that, I'd like to introduce to the program Debbie Jackson and Bryn Tannehill. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Hello. Glad to be here.
Debbie, let's start with you. You definitely have a one of the most vested interests in this, being a parent of a transgender child. Can you tell us what your experience was with your child and how you came to being so involved?
Sure. We have 2 children. My husband and I have 2 children. I think it's important that I point out the husband is in the picture. Their dad's here because so many people think it's a bunch of crazy moms and dads aren't involved or approving. My husband and I had 2 children that we thought were both assigned male at birth. And by the time our second child was four, she had been displaying a lot of cross-gender behaviors for a really long time. And I knew about the LGB part of the community, but I didn't know anything about the T. We assumed, like so many other parents, that maybe we had a gay son, and we were thankful that we had signs at such an early age. And it was when she was four that it wasn't just choices of clothes, choices of toys, choices of friends. It was really her taking on a female identity when she was playing with her friends and wanting to wear female clothes and dress up and be called the daughter or the mom in story time and relating to female characters, that we realized there was something a lot deeper than just liking, you know, shiny things and pink or typical, stereotypical girl items. It was really a part of her. And we're one of the families that's really lucky that she actually articulated that at the age of four, after many months of depression and acting out, unless she was in girls' clothes and getting to kind of take on that persona. She very directly said to us, "You think that I'm a boy, but I'm a girl on the inside." Mm. And we asked some of our friends about that, our friends in the gay community, therapists, and they said, "No, that's not a gay boy to me. I never thought that. I never said that. I think this is something different. This is something deeper." So we went to our pediatrician. She said, "Yes, this is beyond imaginary play. I don't know anything about this. I think you should see some psychologists, get some specialized help." We went to psychologists. They said, "Yeah, we've seen this in adults. I'm not so sure. Go see an endocrinologist." The endocrinologist, thankfully, knew something about trans youth and said, "You have no reason to be here. This is just who your child is. Go back to a therapist, go to a gender therapist," which we did. And the gender therapist said, "Yeah, I've never seen a child this young, but I definitely know that my adult clients have said they knew around this age who they are. So I think we should trust her." And we decided to fully leap into trusting her because we could see the difference when we would talk to her and say, "You could be a girl," than if we were trying to say, "No, you're a boy who likes dresses and that's okay." She was just a different child. And she is now 12 years old and she's doing incredibly well. So she's lived the vast majority of her life completely affirmed. She's never wavered in who she is. And it's appalling after all of these years to think that people who have never met her, who have never met a child like her, who've never talked to us about our experiences, who've never talked to our doctors, are now going to come in and take away her ability to move from a social transition that completely changed her life and, you know, turned our world upside down in what an amazingly happy, well-adjusted child we have, that they're now going to try to take away her opportunity to move forward into a physical transition, to block puberty, to possibly suffer where she would end up developing male characteristics now, secondary sex characteristics, which would undo all of the work that we've done so far.
Right. I've worked with and talked to and written about several families like yours whose child has come out very early, very adamant as to who they are, shocked the parents, you know, that both on the assertion, but more so in their cases about just how adamant their child was as to their identity. And the thing that in those cases that those parents came to was the data on children who were both affirmed and how when they were affirmed and the family was behind them, that child became well-adjusted and centered versus children who were not affirmed, where they led to both mental health issues and suicidal tendencies, in many cases, success at suicidal efforts. And in each case, those families basically came to the reality that they were to be affirmative or they might lose their child in a very tragic way. Were those some of the thoughts that you guys dealt with when you dealt with it initially?
Yeah, very much so. Avery was at the age of 4 before she had articulated everything so clearly to us. She had been acting out for years. They had had a observation day at her preschool to see what was going on, to see what sort of behavioral problems she had, because she had started having problems where she was reverting in behaviors back to biting and kicking and things that two-year-olds do, but at almost 4, she should have grown out of. She didn't want to leave the house. There was so much separation anxiety all of a sudden when I would try to drop her off for preschool. And then at home, the conversations went very dark. She started asking about God and can God make mistakes? And if she died, would she come back again? Could she talk to God about how she would come back? And then she got obsessed with dying and would ask, you know, if I fell off the roof of our house, would I die or just get hurt? How high would I have to fall to die? And, you know, if in a car, how fast do we have to go? If I fell out right now, would I die? And then everything did come to a head for us when she had told us that she was a girl and we were going to therapists. We were involved trying to get the whole family to understand things. And at that point, things weren't moving fast enough for her. And we were driving down the highway one day, and my son, who was a year older than her, 5 at the time, started yelling, "Mommy, Mommy, stop the car." Avery unbuckled. She's trying to open the door. And she had. She had unbuckled her harness and was pulling on the car door handle. We have a dramatic story. Not every kid gets to that. And the thing is, I think not every kid should have to get to that. We know so much more now. We do know that affirming kids and letting them figure them out and not putting pressure on them. We didn't label her transgender. We just asked her who she was. We let her put on the clothes she wanted to put on. And if we gave room to kids to explore their gender, they would be able to figure it out. There are a lot of kids, the binary doesn't work, and they could tell us that, and they could figure it out. The other ironic part about us learning so that we could affirm a child younger and in how we have affirmed her for the last 8 years is that I know other families who help their children socially transition without going to all the doctors first. And then they go to a clinic at the time for puberty blockers, and they say, "We need to help my child now. They're entering puberty. I think we need to stop this and give them more time." The child doesn't show distress because they've been affirmed for so long that they don't have depression and anxiety. Their parents have been supporting them, and then suddenly doctors are like, "Wait, this isn't what we think trans kids are supposed to be like. Maybe they're not really trans. Maybe they're not sure." And we have to move beyond that irony too. We shouldn't be making kids suffer to prove that they need our support. And then once they get to puberty, we shouldn't make them have to suffer through the wrong puberty or years more of thinking about it before we allow them to develop and move through life with their peers.
Amazing that. And I feel so awful that you guys have to deal with that. Bryn, I want to ask you, because you, you know, in your work and your analysis and your writing, you deal with a lot of the misgivings, et cetera, people have about people being transgender. What are they afraid of? Why are they not able to hear parents like Debbie hear the responsibility these parents are taking and trust that those parents are doing what is best for their child?
Well, some people don't believe that kids can know their own gender identity as early as 2 or 3, but the fact is they do. And we have research by Dr. Joe Olson at UCLA that has shown that kids as young as Avery are as secure in their gender identity as their cisgender, that's non-transgender peers. We had more research come out recently that showed that the behaviors in transgender youth and young adults follows the same patterns as their cisgender peers, and that just came out a few weeks ago. So there's that concern that, oh, you can't have a transgender kindergartner. Yes, you absolutely can. And a lot of research seems to suggest that people know their gender identity by two or three. And a lot of times simply asking them what they are is the right way to go, that they will tell you. One of the other things is there's this misconception that you're giving children surgery or hormones at eight or something. No, that's not the case. The way the system works is that when children start entering puberty, and if they have cross-gender identification, that's when they're prescribed hormone blockers, Lupron as an example, or Luprolide, in order to kind of hit a pause button to give them as much time as possible to figure out if, yes, this identity is going to stick. And what we have found is that kids that make it to puberty and still have a cross-gender identification rarely, if ever, stop or change their minds. Even the person who is the primary promoter of the desistance narrative, the kids just stop being trans. Dr. Kenneth Zucker admitted in an interview with a conservative outlet that 85%, in his experience, 85% of kids who are teens and trans don't change their minds, right? So that's one of the things that we saw in the debate on the floor in South Dakota, was them saying, well, most of these kids are going to stop being trans anyway. No, that's not true. And in fact, when they looked at data from Australia, where they have a nice national healthcare system, they found 704 kids that had been prescribed Lupron a couple years ago. They went through their records and found that 96% of them went on to transition. So in this case, that would be cross-sex hormones at 16. So the idea that these kids are going to not be trans, or that this is going to hurt the vast majority of kids, isn't true. As far as the safety of blockers, the Lupron has been around, approved by the FDA since 1985 as a hormone blocker. But in adults, it was approved for use in children who had early onset puberty in 1993. So this is a drug that's been around for 27 years, right? So the argument that, oh, we need more time to study this, like, no, you don't have 27-year clinical trials of drugs. We already did that, right? And this was approved under the old FDA rules that were more cautious before they let drug manufacturers do their own testing. So there's that. And then the idea of cross-sex hormones. So one of the things – sorry, let me go back. Blockers are completely reversible. And this is not just me saying this. This is the Endocrine Society. This is the professional organization for endocrinologists. And this is also the position of the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, and the U.S. Professional Association of Professionals. USPATH. So this is giving kids blockers is the medical standard at this point, right? And it has been for almost a decade now because we've had good results. What we have seen is that children young adults who are not seen as transgender have better mental health outcomes. Well, if you make a kid go through the wrong puberty, and based on the data from Australia, that would be 96% of the time, you're going to end up with kids who are visibly trans and who are going to be mistreated and end up with worse mental health outcomes. Conversely, kids who are affirmed, kids who have never gone through that kind of discrimination, kids who have been going through the standard medical protocols that have been accepted nearly universally at this point, show mental health outcomes that are essentially no different than their peers. That's the gold standard of treatment. If you have a population that's being treated that has health outcomes that are the same as everyone else, right? So we have this.
Right, absolutely.
Right? And then the other part is banning hormones. Well, most of the time, the Dutch protocol says you don't start hormones until 16. A few places in the U.S., it'll start a little bit earlier because you don't want people falling behind your peer group in terms of secondary sexual characteristic development. But this is, again, we are not seeing regret rates. When they looked at regret rates in the United Kingdom, right, there's the, oh, my God, what if they regret it later? Well, actually, they looked at 3,398 case files of transgender people in the United Kingdom, again, nice national healthcare system, and they found that out of those people, only two people detransitioned because they decided that they weren't actually trans, right? That works out to about 0.01%, which is to say,
and
if you
of
have,
those two, and of those two people, I mean, you called it a regret model, but in fact, because they made that decision and there's no ill harm to it, just being able to go through a decisionary process themselves, was there any harm even for those two people?
We don't know because I didn't see a deep dive into it, but it's possible that those people went through minimal or no medical treatment. It is possible that, and I've seen this in some people, is that they go through some amount of medical transition, decide they're not trans, and don't regret the fact that they did explore their gender that way. In fact, I met someone like that just a few months ago. So only 2%, basically in medical literature, a misdiagnosis of 0.01% is nothing, right? So the idea that we are misdiagnosing trans people, that they can't know, that they're too young, that they shouldn't be allowed to make decisions because they might regret them, none of this holds up. But that's the problem. When we look at what South Dakota is doing, as Brody mentioned, they're trying to hide the fact that this is based on religious objections, because all of the science from reputable sources, including, you know, all the major medical associations, say this is the right thing to do. But
I want to actually highlight that.
Or they're willing to.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to highlight what you just said, though, because one of the parallels to this that is happening in state legislatures is the banning of quote-unquote conversion therapy for gay, lesbian, bi kids that are being forced into these quote-unquote therapy programs that are supposed to convince them to be not gay, not bi, not lesbian. And the, you know, the on paper, they look like legislature telling parents in both cases what they can and can't do and who the physicians can and cannot be to do these different quote-unquote disciplines. But what you just highlighted is the most important part of that is that one of those is deemed by all the medical professionals and all the medical organizations as being something severely harmful and damaging to the child ultimately, which is the quote-unquote conversion therapy, which the other one is the exact opposite. In other words, the science behind them is exactly the opposite through even though they on legislation pass and different people putting them forth are kind of making them look for tit for tat. Would you agree?
I would agree, and I'm going to point out, I'm going to go back to the research. There are numerous pieces of research that shows that trans youth who do not have access to health care have worse mental health outcomes than their peers who do have access to it and are affirmed. We also have a new piece of research out by Dr. Jack Treban of Harvard Medical School, and it was published in the Journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics that showed that transgender people who were exposed to conversion therapy as youth are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide. And that study looked at both religious-based conversion therapy and conversion therapy that was supposedly secular, and it didn't find a difference, which is to say that if you're trying to change your child's gender identity, whether through coercion, whether through shame, whether through some sort of talk therapy, whether through religious opprobrium, it's hurting your kid. The odds that your child will attempt suicide jump by a factor of four, and that's terrifying.
Wow.
Unfortunately, given what we're seeing here in South Dakota, this is going to force families to either put the lives of their children at risk, do grave damage to them in the long run, trying to function with bodies that where they experience dysphoria for the rest of their lives, or they're going to have to flee if they want to take care of their kids. And that's a sign of a democracy that is in deep, deep trouble when you are targeting populations such that they must flee in order to save their children.
Let me jump in here for a second.
Yeah, no.
One of the things I think is kind of important, and this is something that our listeners need to, you know, as you're listening to Debbie and you're listening to Brim, even listening to Rob, this is very, very important. What we are talking about is gender. Now, in January of 2017, the National Geographic, very storied publication, about 130-something years old, had an entire issue devoted to gender and gender issues around the globe. Ironically enough, at the time, nine-year-old Avery, Debbie's daughter, was on the cover. But one of the things that was talked about is, what is gender? How is it defined? And more importantly, where is its place in cultural and societal means in daily living? One of the biggest problems that I have found as a journalist and talking with attorneys, talking with activists, is there's a very narrow focus on this. The science and the scientific community, by and large, is absolutely behind the idea that gender is a construct, that it's not this narrowly defined biological, this is the way it's going to be. And what you end up with, and what we're seeing, is that the major religious components of the globe, and I will put Christianity, Judaism, and Islam at the top, being the top three worst offenders of this, is that they are saying gender is genitalia. And this is where the problem is. As we're seeing in this knee-jerk reaction, in this boilerplate legislation that is now through eight states, probably more than that, probably closer to 12 states, including South Dakota, whose House just passed through an extremely onerous bill. The Senate will likely approve it. This governor in South Dakota may sign it. Now, granted, it's going to go to an immediate court test. But what people aren't hearing, and why I think that Debbie's voice, Bryn's voice, Amber down in Texas, and some of the other parents' voices must be heard, is there is a real-world definitive impact on this. And it goes back to the same old tired argument that I've been railing about for years, and that is religion has got to be firmly stepped on. Because at the end of the day, Bryn's got concerns about democracy, Debbie's got concerns about Avery. I've got concerns, okay, that I'm seeing something, okay, that quite frankly isn't provable, running roughshod over people's human rights and civil rights. And the impact is horrible, as Debbie, you know, will tell you from being a parent. Bryn can tell you from being an activist. And from my perspective as a journalist, having to write, you know, too many stories about young trans kids, particularly trans kids of color, whose parents may not be that affirming, killing themselves. And with that, Rob, I'll throw it back to you.
Yeah, and I would say, based on what you're saying, though, Brody, first of all, there needs to be a firm line between church and state. And we should not be passing legislation based on religious beliefs, you know, whether they're benign, like if somebody passed a law saying you see a rainbow in the sky because the Bible says that was a sign from God, you must do some sort of vow of respect legally, you know, that would be ridiculous. And I mean, there needs to be that firm line. But even part of those, even if you're looking at it religiously, none of those, well, I can't speak for Islam because I'm not well versed in it, but in the others, there are no firm principles that would bring harm to these kids. I mean, it's just not addressed. This is based on a superstitious through line in under the guise of religious freedom that's rearing its head. I mean, quite frankly, it's transphobia and bigotry with a nice religious icing on top. So I agree that that needs to be removed. But to Bryn's point before, you know, these are being brought, and your point before, actually, these are being brought not under that guise at all. These are not being brought as religious freedom issues. These are being brought under the guise of junk science. And we need the scientific voice. We need the experiential voice of the parents to get on deck and be heard on this. I mean, this shouldn't even be up for a vote until those factors have been weighed in and understood what it is all about. I kind of want to throw this out to Debbie, and more, though, I think to Bryn, from the perspective of adult transgender individuals you know who have had to come to terms with their identity later in life, what are the viewpoints from those folks on the what ifs they had been supported, recognized, and taken through the process at a younger age? Is that something that, how valuable do they think that would have been?
So outside of just the research that says that people who don't go through the wrong puberty and who aren't visibly trans do much better, one of the most common laments I hear among transgender adults is, I wish I'd transitioned earlier, I wish I'd been able to do something sooner, I wish I'd known that there was the option of transitioning sooner. One of the most common regrets is, I didn't do it sooner. I wish I'd done it sooner. I wish I'd had the opportunity sooner. I feel so many trans women I know feel wish that they'd had that part of their life back in the right gender. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the most common refrains that I hear. Debbie can probably contribute some other things from parents with older trans children as well.
Yeah, I do hear from a lot of trans adults who say the same thing, that it was even hard for them to transition later, knowing that they've known their entire lives who they are, because they were punished or shamed by their parents, and they wish they had been raised in a generation where it was different and they would have had the ability to explore, and they wouldn't have internalized so much hatred for themselves that they had to then overcome in order to be able to transition. And then to Bryn's point, there are a lot of parents who see their kids come out in their late teens or their 20s, and they have to take them to electrolysis, and they take them for facial feminization surgeries, and they have a transmasculine child who ended up really short and has struggled. And there are different things, you know, a deep voice or something that they feel so much guilt over. If I had only seen the signs, or I did see signs, and 20, 25 years ago, I had no idea what I was seeing. I told my child they were wrong, or I just kind of brushed it off. And I understand that there's a lot of regret. There are so many trans adults who want to call parents like me a hero. And I think it's really such a sad commentary on what they had to experience growing up, because we're not doing anything heroic. We're just parenting the kid that we see in front of us, and we're doing what it takes to keep our child happy. I did want to go back quickly to what you were saying, because I'm a recovering Southern Baptist and my parents are the evangelical sort who want nothing to do with us. And I am afraid of the hold that a small number of evangelicals with a lot of money and a lot of power now mm-hmm. have, because they are basing a lot of things on just fear and misunderstanding. And then they are able to persuade followers whose last biology lesson was in eighth grade 30 years ago.
Right.
And we've learned so much. So it's not just that gender is a social construct. It's that biology that we all thought we knew is so wrong. Sex is not binary. the sex is more than genitals. So they want to reduce gender to genitalia. Sex isn't just genitalia. It's also internal reproductive. It's also chromosomes. It's also the endocrinology system of a body. And it's a lot more complicated than that. And it's really frightening that we have people in power with money and influence, and then we have legislators who are willing to go on that old information and think that they know better. Like, we're in a representative democracy here. We don't all get one vote up or down. We don't all get to hear the same things. Not everyone's watching the impeachment trial today, so everyone's not going to get the same information. The legislators that we've elected don't know everything. They're not all endocrinologists. They're not all biologists. They're not all gender therapists. And I really wish that instead of listening to a few powerful lobbying groups and listening to their pastors, they would listen to all the medical experts who come in and tell them that their notions of gender and sex are wrong. And it's really, really frustrating to me that they are willing to brush off all the experts who sit in front of them. Not only those experts in the realm of science and medicine, but the experts like me. I'm an expert in my child. No one else is an expert in my child. I am, and she is, and she can speak for herself too. And they'll listen to those people and then still vote based on religious, evangelical, political influence.
Right, right. That's frustrating and wild, and quite frankly, ignorant. Even from where they're coming from, because if you dig back into what is behind a lot of those traditions, they're highly flawed. I mean, the tradition in especially the Old Testament of the Bible and even probably forward was that the entire sum of a person was created by the male. That's why they call it the seed, because in their limited view of science, that's where the person came from. The woman was seen as simply an incubator who contributed nothing to who that child was. And that's, you know, a lot of the, because they felt that way, a lot of their viewpoints on different things, for example, masturbation in the Bible, was based on that perspective. So it is just unbelievable that we make ramifications of scientific issues today based on something that is essentially superstition. Brody, I wanted to switch gears a little bit. If you could, again, outline which states have these things coming up currently, and if people want to get involved in fighting them and advocating against them, which states should we be focusing on?
The most important focus right now should be on the states of Kentucky and South Dakota, those two. There should be focus on South Carolina. There should be focus on Illinois. There should be focus on Missouri. And I believe I can let Debbie talk about the Missouri thing. The worst of the bills, without a doubt, has got to be South Dakota. South Dakota's is just completely and totally off the rail. And that's the one that we really need to pay attention to. There was an effort yesterday in Iowa, in that state legislature, that was a move to redefine the Iowa Civil Rights and Human Rights Act by striking the word gender, which would have opened up Pandora's box of discrimination. Fortunately, the committee chair of the state judiciary killed the bill before it had a chance to even move out. But the problem is that there's more of these bills out there. We're seeing efforts in Florida. We're seeing efforts in Oklahoma, Tennessee. Tennessee, as you know, just passed that bill that basically made it where gay couples wouldn't be able to adopt or even foster children. What we're seeing here is we've been piecing together the background of it, and it looks like the Alliance Defending Freedom, the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., and the Project Blitz, which is a Christian group that writes legislation have all been working with state houses everywhere, particularly in the South, including places like Louisiana. We're catching wind that there's one of these bills being proposed there, as well as in Alabama. And it's, again, it is targeting the parents like Debbie. It is targeting their health care providers. And in two of the bills that we know of, it's also targeting high school, middle school, elementary counselors and teachers who, by law, are required to be reporters on child abuse and things of that nature. In one bill, and off the top of my head, maybe Brent will remember which state it was, but in one particular bill, there was a requirement in there that there had to be a notification, okay, in terms of trans kids. And these may be kids that may not even be after their own parents. This is kind of like outing gay kids and that sort of thing. So, you know, what this is these states are making an effort. Now, I've spoken to representatives of the American Civil Liberties Union, Lambda Legal, and the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and the law firms are ready to jump. They're ready to defend, but the point has been made. This stuff needs to be cut off before it even gets into the court system, and these states in particular. I think the most important thing, and Debbie and I have had this conversation before, previous to the broadcast, the most important thing that an ally or a member of the LGBTQI community can do for parents like Debbie and for children like Avery, and Bryn is also a parent of a trans kid, that we need to be able to be more than just say we're allies and affirmative. We need to get the shoe leather out there. We need to be making phone calls. We need to be, you know, making sure that people like myself who sit in, you know, editorial decision capacity as part of the media cover these stories and put them out there. I mean, the occasional cover of the National Geographic is, that's nice, but it doesn't lessen the impact of these, you know, forces that are arrayed against the community based on completely flawed, you know, interpretations of whatever it is that they're interpreting, be it religious or other, aren't stopped and shut down by parents and allies galvanized to action. This is the type of thing we need action. We need people at these state houses. We need people talking to, in South Dakota's case, you know, we need people talking to the governor, make sure she doesn't sign the damn thing. In Iowa, when the word got out yesterday, Senator Zach Walls, who knows me, and a few others rallied the troops, and there were a ton of phone calls and a ton of emails, and, you know, they put so much pressure on those nine Republicans on that bill that they had no choice but to kill the damn thing. I think in South Dakota's case, we need to make a concerted effort, especially to that governor and peer, okay, and bury her office on it. You know, at the end of the day, you know, and Avery, correct me if I'm wrong, Debbie, but I'm paraphrasing your daughter, but I remember Avery telling a reporter for, I believe it was USA Today, that had spoken to your family after the Geographic cover came out. I think she told the reporter, "I'm a girl. That's all I want to be." Yeah, and at the time, I think she was only nine. So here's the thing. Listen to the children. I'm a girl. I'm a boy. Yeah. That's all I want to be. I don't think any of
I think
responsibly should have the right to step on a child and step on a children's parents.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, no, I agree, Brody. Although I would that the last thing you said, I think they definitely need the children and their parents need to be listened to. There is a dark, evil side to that, though, where the parents are oppressive and want to change the child into something they're not, and they're brainwashed kids on that. So it's I think the other component to that is we need the responsible mental health organizations and experts to be extremely vocal as well. And I'm hoping that that's the other piece that speaks up here, you know, that not only just issuing policies, but get out and become stronger, much stronger advocates and having their voices known on these bills, that these are anti-science, they are anti-mental health doctrine in their presentation. We're winding down here. I want to give our guests one more opportunity. Debbie, what haven't we talked about here today that you think is an important point to bring up?
I think there are a couple of important points. I think watching all of these bills and knowing the language of the bills is really important. Those little differences, like trying to get mandated reporters to think of someone questioning their gender or wanting to explore their gender, expressing a different gender identity as some sort of emergency situation where they have to call in and tell people. I think one of the very first drafts of a bill, maybe it was in Georgia, the language was so broad and expansive, they were going to punish anyone who supported a child in believing they are a different gender and changing their appearance. And that could even impact kids during that social transition period where they're just changing clothes and changing hairstyles. That obviously changes their appearance and how people would see them and maybe the pronouns they would use with them. And that was going to be even that restrictive. Then there are places like here in Missouri, we get the bonus of them not just going after doctors in the bills, but also saying that any parent who is affirming their child and trying to get medical care for them automatically goes into being investigated for child abuse. So they're trying to weaponize our parenting against us and turn us into criminals for supporting our kids. So there's a lot of nuances in this, but I also think, again, you know, the people who are putting these bills out have been chosen by those organizations. They know they're the ones who will champion and put them forward. We're not going to change their minds. We have to get to all the other people on the committees. We have to get to the governors. We have to tell them that there will be a business impact, just like there was around HB2. We have to make them understand that they are going to hurt a lot more people than just the trans people that they're trying to target. And sometimes they don't care about others, but their own self-interests are going to be what they respond to. Try every tactic. I just want us to be flooding their phone systems and their emails. I want to crash the servers because we need so many people out there communicating this. Tell your company, you know, let them know that our company won't do business, that this isn't okay. We support all people and all identities.
Yeah, perfect. No, definitely. And so, folks listening to us, please do get involved. We are out of time. Debbie, I want to thank you. I'm not going to call you a hero for being a parent because I get you. I would do the exact same thing you did as a parent. I do want to call you a hero for your advocacy work, however, because that is going above and beyond. And I really want to thank you for everything you do. Bryn, you're one of my heroes. You're vocal stance, you're getting out there, your intelligence, everything that you bring to the table in this discussion is outstanding and terrific. And I want to thank you for that and participating today. Brody, thank you for everything you do in getting the word out to the world about everything breaking news and beyond, and obviously for your both your production and co-host work here on this modest little podcast that we hope makes changes around the world. And I want to thank our listeners. Also, don't forget, out in Santa Cruz, that will be playing Saturday night. You can hear it at 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time on www.ksco.com for more LGBT news and entertainment there. For Brody and myself, we will be back again next week. Please tell your friends to subscribe to this podcast. We love to have them, and they can find it on any podcast app. We bring you the best, the most important topics, and the folks that know everything about the different subject matters, and we are pleased to do that. So for those of us on the team and Rated LGBT Radio, I bid you a happy good week, and we will be talking to you again soon.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.